but we're still facing the fact of colonization. In this case, the bid didn't end up winning, and instead going to Northern Art again. So that, in my eyes, is it's erasing and paving over our history and our context. So, you know, and all I can really do is, you know, I understand that it's a difficult and competitive process, but I think at the same time there's something really systemic that needs to be changed in order for these types of projects to really flourish. Each pillar, I had spoken to a couple different chiefs from our nation, actually, to get a background story to each cardinal direction for each pillar. So each side of this pillar has a story that relates to that cardinal direction. In this specific case, being the West, the bear in the West. And you know, actually, a lot of our families have different stories of which animal belongs to which direction. So I really had to be like diplomatic with which which animal was on which pillar. So, the bear to the West, and this idea that it's representing rebirth, and the, you know, in the West represents destruction and rejuvenation. So the tree being a tree of life connected to the bear, the strength of our community and the resilience, and this idea of being reconnected through our ancestors. In the bottom you can see there's bones and of different types of animals that would have fed our people, and they also at the same time nourish all of these plants, just as our bodies nourish the cedar trees, which grow so large after we pass. The connection between the bear being the salmon and leaving the salmon near the trunks of the trees gives it this all these nutrients so that they can grow as big as they grow. And there's just so much interconnection in all of that. And our people never really looked at that as separate. It was always this idea that we belonged and were interconnected to all of this deep and interconnected web of life. So with each piece, I try and keep that philosophy in mind, where I really want to invite the viewer to be part of that conversation. So as you look through each work, you move through a work, and it invites you to move through it. In a sense, it invites you to move through its spirit, that everything has a spirit. And it all relates back to the land, because each form that is created, I study based on the land itself. So this one being titled Breach, which is actually sort of an abstract version of a salmon or an orca breaching out of the water. But it's also open in the middle so that you can actually walk through the entire piece. And that's something that I love about being able to create such a grand scale work, is that it invites you to viscerally be part of it and connect to it, and move through pieces. So it, much like it does to move through the land, and this piece being on the Squamish Ocean is representative of the bow and stern of our oceanic canoes. And I've represented the true to life scale size of how big our canoes would have been, using those old growth trees, up to 80 feet, and I know Splash, you're saying sometimes even 90 feet, or kind of not sure, but huge, right? And it really invites us to think back to that past, and this is also part of a story that is connected to my dad. I was raised hearing him talk about his story of the Great Flood, and how we have stories connecting to Inchcape or Chincape, Mount Garibaldi, as some of you may know, in Squamish, that there was a great flood where it forced our village to raise up in our canoes to escape the water and create a raft near the top of Inchcape. So this stands on the ocean front where it's actually framing Inchcape between the two canoes in relation from the ocean to the land to the sky. and again bringing in those philosophies. And each piece, I really try to start from a block of wood because I feel as I work through the work, it's like I'm connected to my ancestors. And I've learned that through my dad over time, is that it's this real meditative state. It's like, you know, it's almost like it's written in our code or our DNA to work through these materials. And that's what helps, you know, me create these forms, is that I'm relying on my ancestors to help me in this process, to realize these. And they really have a different energy about them when that process is engaged, because it forces me to slow down and really think about what I'm doing. This is a form that's actually taken up after, this is the New Westminster Secondary, or sorry, New Westminster Aquatic Center that they're just completing next year. And the building was built on top of a ravine, Glenbrook Ravine. And I took the shape of the ravine and used that as the main form of the sculpture. And of course I took my own artistic direction and creativity. But I really wanted, again, it to be about that conversation between the land, the artwork, as well as the sky. And it was really interesting too, because if you look at the building, the architecture is also sort of mimicking it in some way too, which I later found out that the architect also did the building based off of the ravine. So it was a really interesting conversation there, and maybe another example of how artwork and architecture can have conversations. Here's a piece that had been fabricated. It stands at 16 feet tall. It's a stainless steel finish, mirror polish, with the idea of it being like water, or it's like this reflective surface. And water being over, like it's, water is Mother Nature's chisel. It's always carving the landscape. And I always found that to be so fascinating about how you go around different parts of the world and look at how water is carved, all these beautifully intricate forms and shapes into stone and rock and sandstone. Just so many beautiful curves and forms. And to my finding through this work, I found that there was a really interesting, happy accident, really, actually, not purposeful, that there was a trigon shape, which comes out of Salish design, that was carved by the ravine. So really, a really beautiful moment there. And this is an example of the seed from our recent exhibition at the 7th. the idea being that it's this form that's been sort of evacuated from the inside, and that's what's really interesting to me now is, as I've been working with Lauren over the years too, like she's also helped form ideas around what that could mean to me, and it's been really inspiring to me to hear her words and her creative ideas. And I think that's where the intersectional collaboration really comes to light, is that it's really all just a conversation that we all have with each other. And I don't think we ever would have arrived here if it wasn't for the multiple conversations that we've had over the years. This idea of this piece being a seed, and we're calling these the seed series. And we're talking of them as if they're seeds of knowledge, that they're spreading. This Coast Salish design is sort of spilling out into the world through these different forms. And they're abstract as they wrap around, but they become more, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? They're familiar as you see their projections on the ceiling and the ground. But as you have to move around it, it's more abstract, so you don't really get the full image. And there's some really interesting things that happen between light and shadow. And when we're thinking about, like through when we went to Japan to kind of get some inspiration, thinking about how in Japanese culture, how there's a huge play between light and shadow. And And I think that's when we went to Japan, there was a lot of that that came out of inspiration came from traveling up there. So this is the piece, this is it, brought into reality. And this is another example of a work that was just recently installed in Port Moody. Again, the idea that you're being invited to walk through. In this case, the title of this work is Halcom, which means blue mussel or mussel. And it's sort of a memorial for that site because it's located in Port Moody, but there is no shell life that really exists in there because of all the oil tankers, and the waters there are just too filthy for sea life to exist. But one can imagine once upon a time before European settlers came that there must have been so much sea life that would have been available in the Brevard Inlet. And these here are the pillars that we recently created for the 7th. And this is an example of how we imagine them to be integrated into architecture. And here are the pieces themselves one of them is on show right now at the Art Gallery, so if you haven't been there, go check it out. But the piece that's at the Art Gallery is here on the right, and you can see again how it projects the shadows down onto the ground, sort of like the seeds of knowledge spreading those forms back onto the land. And you have to excuse part of this is for landscape architects, so I included some inspiration for landscape architects to imagine how our Salish forms could be used as an inspiration. And I think that concludes my presentation. It's just one last note on this piece. This is a lighting design that we're also working on, creating these new lights for institutions to bring more Salish art into the landscape. Thank you.
Thank you, James. Every time I hear you speak, it expands and transforms the way I understand this place and this territory. And I've seen you give this talk many times, and you always add something new and bring something new to the table for us to consider.
And that's the conclusion of part one of our three-part presentation of the 7th Artists on the Radio. this presentation, which will continue tomorrow at just a couple of minutes after 10 o'clock, features artists Laura Brevner and James Harry in conversation with Rick Harry, Cease Weiss, and Aaron Nelson Moody, moderated by OR Gallery Director Jen Jackson. That's who we heard at the end there. We'll be bringing you part two tomorrow at about 10:03. And part three on Thursday at the same time. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Peter Haskell and the dark history of...
I'm going to talk about the 1991 film documentary on him, which was done in context of him not being president or trying to be president, but in what he was doing during the 1980s.
And showed up some of his sort of unsavory tactics.
Well, okay, we'll go over it after a bird note.
All right.
This is Bird Note. When birds swallow berries, they also ingest the seeds within the pulp. After just half an hour or so, they dispose of the seed by passing it through their digestive system, or regurgitating it. Either way, the hard seeds wind up on the ground. There's an evolutionary reason for this. Plants that evolved fruits with edible flesh could attract birds to eat them. Then the birds transport the hard seeds within the soft fruits to new spots for them to take root. But birds do more than just carry the seeds. Their digestive system, including their muscular gizzard, grinds away the hard outer coating on seeds, making them more likely to germinate once the birds deposit them. What's more, seeds in a bird's droppings are prepackaged in nutrient-rich fertilizer when they hit the soil. Birds disperse seeds for more than 300 trees, bushes, and vines in North America. The benefits are mutual. A fruit-eating bird sows more fruit-bearing plants, leading to more fruit for birds to reap in the future. It's a relationship developed over millennia of coevolution. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
So, Peter, tell us about this film.
It's called Trump, What's the Deal? And they tried to get it on cable TV in the New York State area.
Yep.
And they failed. I think they had a theatrical showing. Leonard Stern, which was a business rival, financed part of the film, but it was created not solely by him. He was just did some of the financing of it.
So what was it about the film that caught your interest?
Well, one thing, it's been online since 2015. And what I came across in 2016, and it came across me that it wasn't sort of brought up. Mm-hmm. There are two things, I think, which are quite damning. One is a bit lighter, and I'm going to go to the second one after that. One was that supposedly in 1986, because of Donald Trump, the public ice ring in Central Park had to be reopened. And the city had spent a lot of money doing it, and it failed to bring it up. And then he actually was paid to have it done. And he got somebody else, a Vincent Desmeno, who kind of cajoled him. He wound up not getting paid at all. And it was like, oh, I just did it for the city of New York, when he actually got paid and someone else did free work on it. Now, that's a bit of a lighter one, still pretty bad. I don't like someone taking credit and being paid for. But this was, it was one of his buildings, was Trump Tower, and the contractor for the demolition of the first building, mm-hmm. the contractor he got was just a window washer. That's what he had done previously. And he hired 200 illegal Polish workers. And at that time, Poland was still part of the communist bloc countries. And interestingly enough, you would have thought that they would have said, okay, come to the United States, it's fine. But no, it was they were illegal, of all things. They were paid one-third of the union rate. And they wound, and an actual contractor did not pay them. And there was a court case over this. And actually, one of Trump's own employees, the former labor negotiator with the Trump Organization, he says a few things. What happened was the workers had no masks, no gloves for stripping bare wires with their bare hands, and asbestos was part of the building too. And in the court case, that sort of happened. This is sort of a really interesting thing. Donald Trump's sister at the time was assistant to the U.S. Attorney's Office, and I think she became a judge later, which I was a bit surprised because I remember seeing the film. I forgot about that fact. So not very good. That's the one thing that stood out for me. And actually, the one thing I've heard about him is that in contracting, You're basically paid. You're basically paid three times. Like you're paid at the beginning, the middle of the job, and at the end. And Trump supposedly, repeatedly, this is not in the documentary, but he's not paid the last third in the past. Like he just lets the last third just go, and it gets away with it.
There are lots of stories about that of him not paying people he's got contracts with, people who do work for him.
As I say, it's done in a thing where he basically gets away with the last third because of the jurisprudence of it. It becomes next to impossible to get.
Yeah, I mean, someone has to sue him for the money, and then even if they win a judgment, they have to be able to collect the money from him, which he already owed them, and he didn't pay in the first place, so why is he going to pay the second time around?
And the other thing, we got to talk a bit about Roger Stone, too, some of the information. But to finish off on the film, I was a bit surprised that during the 2016 campaign, this was not brought up. It just sort of lied there. I mean, it was something very obscure and remains obscure to this day. In fact, the Hillary Clinton campaign didn't bring it up or whatever. So I don't, maybe because they're all corrupt in these ways and they don't want to, I don't know. Why it wouldn't be brought up more.
It's hard to say whether it would have made a difference because there have been so many other scandals with Donald Trump
that would seem
to end the career of any normal politician, but he's clearly not a normal politician. He seems to get away with just about anything in terms of having a history of bad practice. Because another story that came up, and it might have been around the time of the 2016 election, was his Trump University, where he started a private university and collected lots of tuition fees and et cetera from students who had to take out loans for all this stuff. And then in the end didn't provide a decent educational experience worthy of either the name of a university or the money he was paid. And then he got sued for that and lost the case, but people still didn't seem to care.
I didn't enroll, but I went to the, this was quite a while ago, there was some place in Surrey, you know, the hotel thing, and this was way before the election run, I think 2010 or maybe a bit earlier, but it was, I think it was what you were speaking of, and I went to see the presentation to supposedly enroll in this thing, which seemed quite fraudulent, actually.
So you dodged a bullet there.
No, well, I was just interested. There was no way I was going to get involved with something like that.
Yeah.
No, but I saw the practices. He was encouraging people even to make a loan and so on. I think that was created because he had to pay property tax on all his properties or something.
Oh, probably.
He was strapped for cash. One of the creators of the Trump presidency was Roger Stone, Roger Stone still.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just on Wikipedia on Roger Stone, but this is sort of interesting about him. Mm-hmm. He was part of a lobbying firm. Actually, they call the term mega lobbying firm. He was last named Black, Manafort, and Stone. And it operated 1980 to 1991. Now, two of their clients was Federal Marcos of the Philippines. And another one was Azuair, the president of Azuair.
Zaire.
I checked it up a bit because I thought, well, you know, they got their independence from Belgium. It might have not have been a bad thing, but it was basically. How he first met Trump in 1979 as part of the Reagan campaign. And it was Roy Cohen who introduced him. He got to meet Trump. And Roger Stone met Roy Cohen, who was the lawyer for Joseph McCarthy, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he seemed to be a big deal in a lot of somewhat nefarious or nefarious, but unsavory dealings over an extended period of time.
Yeah. So anyway, actually, there was a attempt in the year two, in the year 2000, to have a third part, have Trump part of a third party candidate that Ross Perot and Jesse Ventura were part of,
right,
which didn't go anywhere. But so actually, over the years, I mean, in many ways, that the concept of Trump running as president is sort of a Roger Stone concept in many ways. And it was 2019. He was, but the helicopters came for him. He was placed in jail. Yeah,
are you talking Roger Stone?
Yeah, Roger Stone. Yes, and then, but he got pardoned after he lost the election in December 2020. He got pardoned by Trump, but I had heard that he couldn't legally pardon him for some complicated reason, but I looked it up today in the Wikipedia on this, and supposedly he was pardoned, but I think it was a more elaborate legality than that, because he had sort of, anyway, things got complicated, right, or whatever.
So where can people find this film? Is it on YouTube?
Yeah. No, well, no, I would go to a Google directly. It's called Trump. What's the Madeal? I would put Donald Trump 1991 documentary onto Google, and you'll get it very quickly.
Yeah. And, of course, the reference there is because he had I think one of his big rises to fame was when he published a book called The Art of the Deal, which sort of paint a self-written sort of thing, which painted it as some sort of master of deal making.
I guess that's why. I mean, yeah. I just, as a side note, got the title of it.
Yeah.
And actually, in the middle of 1990, he was in debt $294 million. So, Donald Trump. So,
yep.
They say if he put all his money that he got from his family, he was born rich, into status and poor's, he would have more money than
if he just
now
invested it instead of trying to be a business.
Well, just on like an automatic pilot. He would if he just put it in there, he would have gotten more than he has now.
Yep. Well, you know, Trump's a personal hype machine, and he rode it all the way to the presidency, and who knows if we're not it could happen again. All right, so Donald Trump, what's the deal? You can easiest to find it just by Googling that or Donald Trump.
Well, just as a
one, and you can see that his his, go ahead.
I was going to say there was a 2016 interview with Charlie Rose and Roger Stone. And Roger Stone said he's not the Wall Street establishment or country club Republicans. Republicans. He wasn't country club Republicans or Wall Street establishment. And that's what Roger Stone thought was wonderful about Donald Trump.
And that remains the truth today with all the establishment Republican sidelined within the Republican Party, because it's basically his party these days.
Yeah, well, he sort of, I mean, it was supposed to be Jeb Bush was supposed to be the candidate 2016.
And he crashed out early. All right. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you, Peter. Peter will be back next Monday with another chat for us. Tomorrow we have part two of the seventh artist on radio. That'll be coming up at just after 10 o'clock. With part three airing on Tuesday. Ayu Sakamoto will also be in tomorrow with her bringing her arts review. And that'll be on the radio just after we complete the segment on the 7th, the Artists on Radio segment. So we'll be back tomorrow. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. Coming up in a few minutes or moments is Democracy Now! And up at 12 noon is Wandering Rhythms with Nick Legacy. He's away in Peru now, and he's going to be coming back soon with some great stuff.
Hey, SFU. Getting money back for all your empty or refundable bottles and cans just got a lot easier. Just sign up for Returned Express for free. You can bag your containers, tag the bag, and drop it through the window at the new Express and Go container in the East parking lot. return it will count your containers and credit your refunds to your online account. Learn more at returnit.ca/SFU.